Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. I've got 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast, interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Friday, the 26th of July, and coming up on the program, the key priorities for the new Chief Justice. Is prison smuggling out of hand? The Paris Olympics about to start amid boxed-in security, and why the cost of orange juice is soaring. Now, not unexpectedly, President Ramaphosa has appointed Mandisa Maya as South Africa's new Chief Justice, and that appointment is with effect from the 1st of September. Maya is the current Deputy Chief Justice and takes over from Raymond Zondo. More now from Mbekizile Benjamin, Research and Advocacy Officer at Judges Matter. And first of all, welcome, and how does her appointment then reflect any progress and transformation within the country's judicial system?
Well, it reflects a significant step in the transformation of the progress of the South African judiciary, because if you look back just 30 years ago in 1994, there were only two women out of about 150 judges across South Africa. And currently we have about 45% of our judiciary being women, and having women as the Chief Justice also, I think, signifies or solidifies that progress that has been made in transforming the judiciary and making it more diverse and perhaps more closer to how South Africa looks. There is, of course, still a gap in that Justice Maya will now become one of about five women heads of court in a heads of court forum that has about 16 seats. So perhaps the goal now is to have more balanced leadership in the judiciary so that more women can have a greater say in the decision making when it comes to judicial policy and other issues affecting the judiciary.
How close do you think this country is to closing that gap?
Well, I think we are making a lot of strides. In the last 10 years in particular, we've had a record number of excellent, capable women being appointed as judges, and a lot more making themselves available to be in the leadership positions. So there is a lot of progress, and I think Justice Maya's appointment will add to that momentum when it comes to diversifying the judiciary while still retaining quality at the same time.
Specifically, though, what needs to change? She can't do this on her own.
No, she absolutely cannot do it on her own. I think one of the significant things about Justice Maya is that she has been in leadership positions in the judiciary before. You'll recall that she was the head of the Supreme Court of Appeal from 2017 to 2022. And so she's quite familiar with the leadership dynamic in the courts. And so she will need to rely on the heads of courts across the country. She will need to rely on the Judicial Service Commission, which she will now chair. She will also need to build relationships with the Ministry of Justice and also Parliament. I think the combination of all of those stakeholders will assist in pushing forward the transformation that we need and the transformation that the Constitution calls for, because the Constitution doesn't only want white faces to be replaced by black faces. It wants a more substantive kind of transformation where the rights in the Bill of Rights are lived for most South Africans.
All well and good, but where do you think the log jams are right now in terms of transformative representation?
Actually, the log jams are often outside of the judiciary. One of the big problems in the legal profession is that women are not given the opportunity to get good quality legal work that will prepare them for judicial office. The briefing patterns, or how lawyers and advocates are given work, still along really sexist and racist lines, if it can be as blunt as that. And so there is a gap in that many more, we have a lot of women law graduates coming out of our law schools. There are a lot of women coming out with masters in quite complex fields like competition law, commercial law, even shipping law. But those women never really make it through the legal profession to get to the upper echelons. And so that is the big gap. And, you know, our judiciary really should be made up of only those lawyers who've made it to the top of their game. And so that is the big gap, the pipeline that feeds into the judiciary. And I think that is something that Justice Meyer can advocate for, but as a judge, she can't really do much practically to change it. It still needs to be a conversation in the broader legal community.
Beyond the issue of transformation, the Chief Justice also emphasizing the importance of maintaining judicial independence and accountability. What measures then do you think are crucial to uphold these principles under her new leadership?
Well, there are a number of measures, and perhaps maybe we need to start to contextualize the problems that are a threat to judicial independence, one of which is just the resourcing of the courts. In the last week, we've heard from the Minister of Justice that the superior courts will get a 13% budget cut. And that is a cut to a budget that is already a shoestring budget. So they are cutting right down to the bone. And that affects the effectiveness of the judiciary, because we hear now that cases in the Pretoria High Court, for example, if you want a trial date, they are only issuing trial dates from the first term, the beginning of the year in 2029. That is 5 years from now. So that is a huge threat to the independence of the judiciary and the effectiveness of the judiciary. The other threat is, of course, the support that is given to judges. We know that in a lot of courts, judges don't have researchers, they don't have proper admin staff. And one of the priorities that Justice Meyer mentioned in her interview was to move the administration of the courts away from the executive or the Ministry of Justice closer to the judges, so that they have a greater say on how this shoestring budget is spent, what priorities are focused on, so that at least with the little money that they have, they're able to deliver justice to a lot more people.
Do you think there is a fight looming in that respect?
I think that the fight has been brewing for some time, even during the period of Chief Justice Zondo's tenure, where Justice Zondo made it very clear that as judges, they have tried to put forward a proposal to the executive, but there hasn't been progress. And even after the judges' conference in December, Justice Zondo demanded a meeting with the president so that they resolve this issue. That meeting has happened, but we haven't really gotten any update on what steps are being taken. The positive sign, though, is that the Minister of Justice, the new minister, Ms. Thembisi Melane, has mentioned that they will try to meet with the judges to make sure that they resolve it. But there seems to be a coming together on the issue, but there's still a long road to come. So it's still early days at this stage.
I've got one more question. In what ways do you think the Chief Justice will be able to work to enhance public confidence in the judiciary, given that over time it has eroded?
Well, the most important thing that Justice Meyer can do as Chief Justice is to maintain high quality judgments out of the courts, and they should come out as quickly as possible. That, I think, will enhance public confidence, because the primary role really of the Chief Justice is to make sure that the courts deliver on their mandate. And that is something that she has tried to do quite well, actually, at the Supreme Court of Appeal. The Constitutional Court has its own challenges, and so we're hoping that she will address them as quickly as possible. And then obviously to make sure that the courts are able to move cases as quickly as possible, because that is also something that undermines public confidence. And that could easily be a boost to people's trust in the courts.
Becky Zeely Benjamin, Research and Advocacy Officer at Judges Matter. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And coming up on the program, we are in Paris ahead of the Olympic Games opening ceremony a little later on today. But before that, what's the difference between a hotel and a prison? Well, nothing, it seems, if the contents of a raid on the Johannesburg Correctional Centre are anything to go by. Listen to this. PlayStations, Wi-Fi routers, manicure nail kits, designer perfumes, and flat-screen plasma television sets were all seized during a raid. I'm in conversation now with Singabako Ngumalo from the Correctional Services Department. Welcome and thank you very much for joining us. If I read that list out, it sounds like a branch of Macro. What's wrong in the Department of Correctional Services? Why is this happening?
A very good day, and thank you for having us. As Correctional Services, we on record having said that the amount of contrabands that you often confiscate in our facilities is a point of concern, and we are doing everything possible to clean these facilities. Hence, you will see from time to time where we'll conduct these raids, but also making the point that we tighten our security measures across our centers. Hence, this raid is not just to clean, but we also ask our correctional facilities to say, what is it that they are doing in making a point that it becomes impossible for people to smuggle these items. So that raid did disturb us when you look at the amount of that contraband. It's not something that we could anticipate.
How exactly is it finding, is this contraband finding its way into prisons? And in what way have you tightened your security measures? Of course, I understand that there are certain strategic elements that you can't give away. But broadly, yes. What are you doing?
There are four categories of people who are involved in the Smuggling Act. The first one is our own officials, the dirty ones. The second category, it's inmate themselves, those who work with spans outside and those who will be traveling from court. And the other category is contractors who have access to our facilities. The fourth category is the public, those who visit inmates. It's so painful when we have to call the police to come and effect an arrest because someone was trying to smuggle dacha, drugs and other things. Hence, then, we've been saying the traditional methods that we've been utilizing to search, perhaps they are not assisting us much. Hence, we are looking at technology to say, you know, can we then find means where even if, let's say, a cell phone has been smuggled, but it becomes a tool that one cannot use because, you know, there will be no network or it cannot just function. So there are options that we're looking at. I can't disclose that, but it's something that as a department, we're looking at it closely. Mm. And we are under extreme pressure because the damage that is happening is big, because it's not just people using these cell phones for fun, but some threaten witnesses, some even make a mockery of our justice system.
As far as this particular raid at the Johannesburg Correctional Centre is concerned, who's been held accountable?
We have asked the correctional facility there to give us a detailed report in terms of them accounting to what transpired there. And out of that, we will then institute our own investigation. And there must be accountability, because it cannot be that you will have a facility with such a huge amount of contrabands and we do not take any action. Action has to be taken, yeah.
It also raises questions about how effective your intelligence gathering is.
You will have an intelligence gathering, but it has to be assisted by the vigilance of our own officials as well, and their commitment, you know, from to say when they pick up some of these things, you know, how quickly are they able to, you know, remove them. But even for them identifying some of the dirty officials that are involved in this thing, so that they are not given sufficient time to continue with this act, because a day a person being involved in smuggling, taking things in and out, does cause a huge damage. And even you look at some of the other items which were there, you know, something like a PlayStation, it is so big, not something that a person can easily hide in his body. So hence we are saying to the facility, you know, as a report in terms of what's happening here, because our facilities are mandated to conduct their own searching exercises. So we want to know how many searching exercises have they conducted, when did they do them, and what is it that they managed to find, and the gaps that I identified, what is it that they did to close them.
You will concede that this is not a new problem, not just at the Johannesburg Correctional Centre, but other prisons as well. What I'm interested to know is how many so-called dirty officials have been held accountable and actually prosecuted?
When we conduct these raids, I'm just talking about the ones where you find that head office is leading. Yes, we do find these contrabands. And in our quarterly meetings, we ask our regional offices to provide us with an update in terms of the number of officials that they've dealt with for a variety of misconduct, which does include smuggling and other things. You will get that report, but then what we then picked up, say, we need to start isolating those that are being disciplined strictly for smuggling, because that's a category that now we need to give more attention so that we don't put everyone
in
the same bag.
That's the process, but you haven't answered my question. My question was, how many dirty officials have been held accountable and prosecuted?
We are on record having stated that just in the previous financial year, we had 66 officials that we dismissed. And for this current, for the financial year that just ended in March, one will have to collate those figures and then make them public, because it's a matter of public interest. But we do take action, and we do not just dismiss these officials. We even open criminal cases against them. 2 days ago at MLO, we caught two of our officials trying to smuggle Dacha and the mobile phone. We called the police. They effected an arrest. They're in the police as I'm talking to you. So it's not just a project, but it's something that as a department we are committed to, because we have to clean our facilities.
Singa Bako Ngumalo, thank you very much indeed. Speaks for the Department of Correctional Services.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, if you've been grocery shopping recently, you'll know this item has become very, very expensive. Drier and warmer weather conditions are expected to have a negative impact on the production of oranges, and prices are soaring compared to last year. First National Bank Commercial's senior agricultural economist, Paul Makube, is with me now. And first of all, Paul, welcome. Is orange juice becoming a luxury?
Yes, globally it has become a luxury, given those factors that you have just outlined, and it's not only a South African problem; it's actually a global problem. Yeah, production challenges in the US and Brazil, they account for about 85% of the juice market, and obviously exporting to various jurisdictions, to Europe and so on. And supply tightness out of that has resulted in the spike in prices of orange juice.
Paul, when you talk about production challenges as far as the United States and Brazil are concerned, is it simply linked to climate, in other words, drier and warmer conditions, or are there more issues regarding challenges to the supply chain?
Yeah, it's a combination of climate change issues with drier and warmer weather in some instances, as well as diseases that impacted on the crops, which resulted in some areas in the U.S. having to uproot some of the trees, and they're not growing their orchards, as well as in Brazil. And obviously that has an effect of shortages in the long term before we get a supply response in terms of an increase in the hectarage or planted area under the crop.
Now, Paul Makube, as far as South Africa is concerned, I am aware that the citrus industry is a significant contributor to the agri component of gross national product. What are you able to tell me about revised lower export estimates for Navel and Valencia oranges that the Citrus Growers Association has flagged?
Yes, obviously, locally, issues of weather, recently as well, that impacted on the quality of the fruit in terms of sizes, which made them cut their estimates from earlier projections at the beginning of the season, which means lesser exports to the world market. But overall, still a bit about 8% higher than the previous year, but down from the original estimate. So it's not that the crop is totally falling in terms of exports. It's just that the growth in the export volumes has decreased, and they have found an alternative market, which is the processing market, which means that some of the fruit that should have been destined for the export market will now be redirected to the processing market, which is also growing given the challenges on the global market. If you look at the processing market, which historically above 20% of the total production, in 2023 it was about 23% of the total production. That is the processing market. We expect that to continue to grow given the shortages and the high demand on the international market.
So there is a bit of good news there, but in the short term, South African consumers are suffering. There's been an increase in orange prices of over 50%.
Yes, definitely. I mean, if you look at the fresh produce markets, accounts for about just about 6% of the total production of oranges in the country. And obviously, you know, given the competitive prices on the juicing market, which means in most, you know, the high demand for juicing will attract more fruit in that direction, the local market will still be supplied, but the consumers will still have to pay a bit of a premium given the competitiveness of the juicing market in this case.
Is it just the orange sector that has been affected as far as the juicing market is concerned, or other fruits also impacted?
The orange market has been the biggest, you know, historically on the international market and locally. But, you know, given the challenges that side affects the whole value chain in other areas, which means that, you know, some of the fruits might be attracted to the juicing market to provide alternatives for the consumers.
So what other types of fruit would we be looking at?
We're looking at your grapefruits, your lemons as well. Mm-hmm. In the bigger scheme of things.
Paul, given the pressure that the orange industry is facing right now, both growers and also in the juicing market, I'm assuming this is downstream going to have a negative impact on jobs.
Well, not necessarily, because if you look at the juicing market, it means investment in juicing capacity, which will provide some jobs. And the fact that it does not mean scale down on orange production in the country. In fact, to the contrary, it actually makes improves the situation for the producers, because they've got an alternative when they don't have sufficient quality for the export market. There is an alternative market that provides them with a relatively, you know, good price, as it were.
But it's a much smaller market, and also the juicing sector is increasingly becoming automated.
Definitely it is becoming automated, but at farm level, you still retain your staff complement, because you're not scaling down on the score. It's just that when you have quality issues in seasons where your fruit is smaller, which means that, you know, not you know, good enough for exports, then you can redirect it to this market and still get a bit of a better price of that. So it's still a smaller market, but it's growing given what we see now in terms of growth. Yes, in 2022, about 15%. We are now talking about 23% market share in 2023. So it will grow even in 2024.
Given the increasing increase in the price of orange juice, is a price war inevitable within the market, which we also know is highly competitive? In other words, you know, more promotion, more discounts.
That is likely to happen on the domestic market. I mean, especially given the current, you know, tough economic environment for the consumer. There will be that kind of inclination to bring about those specials for their consumer, but still at very competitive prices for producers.
Paul Makube, thank you very much indeed, senior agricultural economist at FNB. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
The Paris Olympic Games that begin today will be one of the most high risk in history. As you well know, France is grappling with deep internal divisions, and more broadly, the current global geopolitical landscape also marked by increasing tension between major powers. Obviously, that would further amplify any kind of security threat. So let me take you now to the French capital, and reporter Adnan Mohamed is with us. Adnan, welcome to you. So with the opening ceremony about to start later today, give me a sense of the build-up.
Yeah, no, it's been absolutely electric here. Just to go back a day, yesterday when I arrived here yesterday, and having seen on TV what happened to the Blitz Box, I thought I would get here and hear that they're out of the competition. So as we came from the airport past the Stade de France, the train stopped. Nobody could get in because of there were so many people coming from the stadium. And then when I got to the apartment where I stay, I said the Blitzbach had made it through and managed to rush off. I just got there when they scored the first try. And it was absolutely amazing. It was like deja vu, like last year at the Rugby World Cup, but times two, because the stadium was like fully, fully packed because France also played in the quarterfinal. And I've been to many sevens tournaments before, but this is the Olympic Games, and there were probably over 70,000 people there. And you can imagine what the trains look like and so on. So today, because it's the opening ceremony, a lot of people will be, the host where I'm staying at the Airbnb already left this morning to go meet up with his friends. So they're making a whole day out of it. They're expecting I don't know if you know, but it's the first time ever at the Olympic Games where they will be having the opening ceremony not in a stadium. It will be on the Seine River, and it's also open to the general public. So you don't you can purchase tickets to get nice spots to see the procession. So that the countries will be coming in, 10,500 athletes will be coming in on boats on the Seine River. So that is going to be something completely different and I think unprecedented that hasn't been seen before.
Anand, are you very excited about this? You're painting such an astonishing word picture. I mean, this is a big deal, isn't it?
Yes, Jeremy, this is my fourth Olympic Games. I've been to Beijing in 2008. I've missed out in London 2012, but I was in Rio 2016 and then the last Olympic Games was so sad because it was 2020, but it happened in 2021 because of COVID, and there were no spectators allowed. That, for me, was the saddest thing to see in Japan in 2021, because you as an outsider could go into the stadium. All the locals stood outside, and it was really, really sad. And this is now completely different. I can't believe that it's just been a couple of years, 3 years, and the world has changed so much. So to have, I think they're expecting over 500,000, 600,000 people at the opening ceremony tonight.
Give me a sense, if you can, about what you're able to discern around security. Conventional wisdom says these games are going to be one of the most high risk in history. What have you learnt, and are you seeing anything on the streets?
No, definitely on the streets, the police presence or the police visibility, it's everywhere. You can just literally walk 100 meters down the road, and I'm based in Saint-Denis where the aquatic center and the Olympic Stadium is, where they will have the athletics. And in and around the stadium, it's cordoned off. The police presence, it's everywhere. So you can see, obviously, they pulled out all the stops to make it as safe as possible for everyone. And I expect today is going to be probably the biggest challenge because of all the people going to be concentrated in one area in and around the Eiffel Tower and the Seine River.
Talking about all the people, though, I'm also seeing this morning that the TGV, the high-speed rail network, has been compromised. Number of arson attacks that have disrupted the transport system. The last thing that the country needs before these games start, I imagine.
Yeah, those are some of the things that... you know, if I ever think back to Japan, there are always those kind of scares and risks, and it's obviously there to instill fear in people. How serious the threat is, or how bad the situation is, I'm not exactly sure. But it normally, in and around Olympic Games, you have these kind of threats. But hopefully it doesn't affect the proceedings on the day.
In any event like this, the focus is always on the medal count. What's the sense as far as South Africa is concerned, Adnan, and how are we playing it this year?
Yeah, look, let's just look at the blitz box. People were not very upbeat about the performance, but I think they... I just spoke to the captain last night and I asked him what was the difference, and he said they got an inspiration from last year where the Springboks won here. It was ironic, it was at the same stadium, and they got a message from the minister, and I don't know who else he mentioned that... Possibly from the rugby hierarchy to give them a word of encouragement, and they could possibly medal. If they win the semi final, they will still play. They could, or they lose, they could still play off for a bronze, which was in the case in Rio when they lost one. So there was no medal expected because they were the last team to qualify. They had to literally win the tournament in Monaco to get here. So to kick out New Zealand. In the quarterfinals, and Ireland also exiting in the quarterfinals. Then coming to the swimming, I'm expecting Tatiana Schoenmaker, now Smith, to maybe pick up two medals. At every Olympic game so far, there's always been, in my experience, it's always been a surprise. If you look back to Atlanta, Josiah Tawane winning the gold medal in the marathon, that came totally out of the blue. At the last Olympic Games, Bianca Buitendag in the surfing, silver medal. Nobody expected that. So I'm hoping somebody... it's just been a trend with Africa that it's always somebody that comes with a surprise. In the other athletics events, maybe the 800 could get Prudence and Akani in the 100 and the 4x400 and 4x100 relay. Wade, as you know, probably no one knows that Wade is not running in the 400 meters. He's decided to concentrate solely on the 200. But I think with that in mind, he will be able to also contribute in the 400, 4x400 relay and the 4x100, which would give South Africa a good chance there as well, because they've got a fairly strong team.
And Adnan, there's a performance bonuses here. If you, any South Africa that wins a gold medal this year, what, 400,000 rand, silver worth 200,000, and bronze 75,000. So there certainly is something to play for.
Yeah, definitely. And I think also the federations has also come to the party. I see ASA, the president, James Maloya, said that they will add, if there are medals, they will add to that those incentives that's already set up front. So there are added incentives as well. Yeah, for me, nobody expects someone like Gerda Steyn to win a medal. But knowing her personally, as the way she prepares and what she has achieved and how she has progressed, we might see a surprise there as well. That's just a gut feel that I have.
Look, I'm not going to lie. We are all very envious. Myself and my engineer, Edward, we are listening to this conversation and we really wish we could be in Paris with you. Adnan Mohammed, thank you very much indeed. Have a great time and perhaps we'll talk in the next 10 days or so. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you. And just before I leave you, on our online poll yesterday, the use of artificial intelligence in the practice of law, I asked if it was helpful, worrying, if it needs more study, and over 50% say we still have a lot more interrogation of the issue to do before it is universally expected. Today's online question references an interview we had a little earlier, the soaring cost of orange juice in South Africa, up by as much as 50%. So is it a luxury now? I need my morning OJ. Or I've switched to water. If you have a view on that, please go to our X or LinkedIn pages. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.